Hello and welcome to the All Terrain Podcast, a brand new series from the Youth and Children's Ministry Unit of the Salvation Army in the UK and Republic of Ireland. I'm Matt White, and in each episode, I'll be inviting a guest to take a hypothetical hike as we find out about their real life journey to this point. In this episode, I'm joined by Alexander John Shire. Alexander John is a psychologist, spiritual director, theologian, and author, and he's the creator of Quadratos, the four gospel journey for radical transformation. And if you're a regular listener to this podcast, you will recognize his name, but you'll also know the founding questions of Quadratos because they are the four questions we ask in each episode of this podcast. So it is a massive pleasure to have Alexander join me here. Alexander, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
It's a delight to be here.
For people who don't know necessarily, or maybe haven't read your work, these four questions that we do, these are the Quadratos questions, the four questions we ask on this journey. You developed this idea, right?
I developed this idea, but I think the questions really come out of each of the four Gospels.
Mm. Mm. And tell us a bit about you. Tell us a bit about your background and where you come from.
Well, I come from the United States. My home is in New Mexico, which people are saying Mexico. I'm like, no, it's actually a state within the United States. We don't have a great many people, but it's a very diverse state in that we have many indigenous peoples along with a tradition of Spain and Mexico. So it's quite...
Does it border Mexico?
It borders Mexico on the south.
Okay.
And it borders Texas on the east and Arizona on the west.
Wow.
And Colorado on the north.
Wow. And tell us a bit about your background, because I gave you an introduction, but psychologist, spiritual director, theologian, author, creator of Quadratos. Where does all this come from?
So I'm a first generation Lebanese immigrant. My grandparents came to the States in the late 1800s. They brought my parents in their arms. Mm. So I grew up in the American South in the state of Alabama in Birmingham.
Wow.
In the 1950s and the 1960s, which were very, very tumultuous, conflicted years.
So the civil rights movement is sort of burgeoning and beginning?
Right. And what many people in the States don't realize is that the KKK, which was essentially a terrorist organization, was not only terrorizing African Americans, but all immigrants in the South, and especially those which had a Catholic background.
I didn't know that.
So at 7 years old, as I, in my book, I think I start the book with the story of at 7 years old, I stood outside my grandmother's house after it had been firebombed by the KKK.
Wow. So how old would you have been then when Dr. King was kind of making speeches and all those kind of marches were taking place?
So I was just reaching adolescence.
Oh, wow.
In the 1960s. I was in downtown Birmingham listening to Martin Luther King.
Physically listening.
No. I saw the demonstrations. I saw the dogs and the fire hoses, but not on television. So I was definitely there.
Mm.
You know, one of the things that I should share about my life is I was raised in this Lebanese community, but in my house, we had this incredible woman who was African-American who raised me. She worked in our house for 64 years. She was a member of our family in every way, but there were lines.
Mm.
And one of the stories I often remember is like 11 or 12 years old, I came home from school. She was there. She had a snack waiting for me at the breakfast table. She sat down at the table with me. She only sat at the table with me when no one else in the family was at home. Otherwise, her place was in the kitchen.
So there really were lines. Yeah.
And this particular day, she started out with, she was quite distressed, I could tell. And she would, and I'm almost embarrassed to say, but she was used to call me Master Alex. And that was the old South. And she would stop and she would start, she would stop and she would start. And I knew that there was something that she wanted to ask me.
Mm.
And finally, I just said, Emily, what is it? What? And she said, well, you have to promise me you won't tell your parents. Now, this is, you know, for a 12-year-old to be in between a woman who really is my second mom and my parents.
Mm-hmm.
But I could see her distress, and so I was... Absolutely. What is it? What is going on? And finally she said, will you teach me to write my name? And what is going on here is she wants to go register to vote.
Wow.
And to register to vote, you have to be able to write your name.
Yeah.
And she is deathly afraid. And I honestly don't know what the resolution would have been, but she is so afraid that if my parents find out that she wants to register to vote, that she's going to be fired. And at this point, she would already have worked in the family for 25 years.
So did you help her?
Absolutely.
Did your parents ever find out?
No. I never told them.
Okay. What would they have done if they had?
You know, I want to believe that they would have gone against the cultural norms, but I don't know. I really don't know.
Wow.
I will say that I never heard my parents or my grandparents ever speak a negative, bigoted word about anybody.
Which in the 60s in the South is no mean feat.
No, absolutely. And yet the cultural pressure and the peer pressure, I don't know what the answer would have been.
Wow. So you grew up there. You trained first as a psychologist?
So I'm named Alexander.
Yeah.
And I was given that name by my father at birth. And I come from a long line going back in the village in Lebanon. I come from the family that produces the priest in the village.
Oh, okay.
Generation after generation. And the son at birth, who is to be the next priest, is given the name Alexander.
Oh.
And my father tells a story about he wasn't going to name a son of his Alexander, but when I was born, he looked at me and said, he's an Alexander. So I grew up in the family with this obligation.
Mm.
And really, I mean, it's like once you're in a Lebanese family, once your father makes this proclamation, you don't have a choice. I was fortunate that I had an inclination to spirituality.
Okay.
I loved theology. Mm. I loved psychology. So it fit for me. And but I negotiated with my father, who wanted me to go to seminary immediately after high school or secondary school.
Mm.
And I wanted to go to university first. Okay. And so I went to the University of Notre Dame.
Oh, yeah. I like Jed Bartlett in The West Wing.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And had my world blown open.
Yeah.
And I am so grateful for what happened to me at Notre Dame.
Hmm.
And for my father, it was the very worst thing that could have ever happened.
Really?
Yeah. Because
Notre Dame, if I'm right, is a university that's founded in Catholicism.
Yes.
So it has a strong, they're called the Fighting Irish.
It's called the Fighting Irish.
Yeah, go Irish.
Absolutely.
All my West Wing / weird American knowledge is coming back to remind me. So I guess in many ways it would have felt to be quite a safe bet.
It was a safe bet, although my father really, I think, instinctually knew that it would have been better for me to go to seminary.
Because
he had a very narrow understanding of Catholicism, a very, very devout man, very devout. Both my parents were very devout, sincerely devout, which I deeply respect. Mm. And yet their way of understanding God was quite narrow.
Yeah.
So going to Notre Dame was quite a stretch for him, but he stretched and he allowed me to go.
Wow.
And while there, I had the most incredible theology, the most incredible psychology. And my major was actually anthropology.
Okay.
When I was there, there was this little erudite, passionate man teaching in the theology department about story and about myth. And his name was Joseph Campbell. And nobody knew who Joseph Campbell was at that point. I mean, in fact, Joseph Campbell didn't get his fame until after he died.
Mm.
But there he was teaching about how the scripture was great universal story and how it had a structure and a pattern to it, which made it a complement to the great scriptures around the world.
Yeah.
And he just blew all the hinges off of my small sense of God and my small sense of humanity.
Mm.
And suddenly I was discovering a Catholicism and a Christianity which was a universal path and where all the world's great traditions were brothers and sisters.
So then seminary would have been what your dad would have hoped for next, or by this stage as he figured out he's not going to seminary?
No. I went to seminary.
Okay.
And I had a crisis in seminary. It wasn't a faith crisis, but I had a church crisis.
Okay.
For whatever reason, to me, God has always been a very present reality.
Yeah.
but the church holding that God began to fall away. And I got to seminary, and two things happened at seminary. And the first was my theology was very narrow. Mm-hmm. What I was being taught was very narrow. And while at Notre Dame, I'd had this incredible, broad, compassionate view of spirituality and who our God is, I got to seminary and it was, here's the question, here's the answer, dot the I. Mm. And I was bored out of my mind. Mm. But the second half of that was that I had begun to know myself in college as a gay man. Mm. And all the way through my discernment for seminary, I was very upfront with all the people who were in the process of interviewing me about the fact that I was a gay man. That I was accepting the discipline of celibacy, but I was not going to be neutered. Mm. And everybody said, yes, yes, yes. But I got into seminary and the answer changed. And it was, you can't talk about being gay. You must be celibate, but you can't. And I was like, this is not working for me. I can't be, I can't accept the discipline for celibacy if I have to pretend to be neutered. Anyway, I began to get depressed, and I actually would say I was at some level suicidal.
Wow.
And I started to have very, very painful dreams, and I realized that I needed to leave seminary. At that point, I thought I just needed to leave that seminary.
Yeah.
I didn't quite yet understand that I was never going to go back to seminary.
So you leave seminary.
So I leave seminary, and I probably should back up a little bit back to my time at Notre Dame and Joseph Campbell, because what Campbell started was he was teaching us that the great human universal story told around the world and throughout culture and time and era can be seen as having a four-part pattern to it. Mm-hmm. And he would say, and I have come to believe, that if the great human story doesn't have these four parts to it, it doesn't get recorded more than a few years, that it sort of falls away.
Okay.
That there's a structure, if you will, about what a great story is and what it does for us. Mm. And at the very same time that I'm hearing Campbell talk about this, I'm also becoming aware of the research that early Christianity not only had these four gospel texts, but that they were read in a particular sequence.
Yeah.
And then I become aware of Bishop Irenaeus in the second century. Hold on, folks, this is not going to be too long. But, you know, Bishop Irenaeus in the second century, who is the first person that we have a record of writing about the choice of gospel text, his opening line is, the revelation is one, and by that he means the life of Jesus the Christ is one, and we must have four accounts. Mm. And no one... Literally, no one in the last 500 years of scripture scholarship has gone back to Irenaeus and tried to understand what he knew about why he said the basis of the gospel text must be four.
Yes.
And this is so odd because we think that we have these texts because they're the true eyewitnesses of Jesus, and they are. But he didn't say we're going to go search for the true eyewitness of Jesus.
Yes.
He said, we must have four accounts.
Yeah.
Precisely. Not one, not three, seven, not 50.
Yeah.
So what did he know about fourness?
Yeah.
Well, okay, now I go back to Joseph Campbell, who's given me the first key to this new understanding, where he says every great story must have four parts. And he names these four parts as hearing the summons to the journey. Mm-hmm. And secondly, facing times of great trial and obstacle. Mm-hmm. And third, receiving a new gift, or his word was boon, or insight. Mm-hmm. And the fourth part is returning with this gift or this insight to community in service. Mm. And I remember 1972, 1973, as I'm sitting with all of these pieces of data, and I can't see how they fit together, but I had the intuition that there had to be some link between Campbell talking about this four-part journey that's part of humanity, and that Irenaeus says we have to have four accounts that we call the gospel. And that started me on a 30-year search scholarly and devoutly, praying, researching, exploring, and trying to figure out, was there a plausible way that this fourness that Irenaeus spoke of that led to the early Christians saying, these are the texts we're going to call the gospel. And finally, in the year 2000, by a scholar here in London, the Reverend Robin Griffith Jones, who I understand is Master of the Temple. And Robin, if you're listening to this, I'd love to meet you someday. Wrote an incredible book called The Four Witnesses. And in this book, he summarizes what's going on in the community at the time that the gospel is composed or revealed. And so he talks about what's going on in Mark, what's going on in Matthew, what's going on in Luke, what's going on in John, in the communities where the text is, is revealed. And I looked at his narrative, and as someone who at this point had become a psychologist trained in trauma work, initially I immediately perceived how each of these four communities were in a trauma. Which just basically means they're in a moment of conflict over a question that they don't know how to resolve. And I could look at the narrative that Robin Griffith Jones had summarized so beautifully and say, I know this. I know this from Campbell. I know this from my search of the Christian mystics. I know this from the Ignatian exercises. I know this from Teresa of Avila and the Interior Castle. I know this from the ancient church's four-step process for how you baptize person, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just in that moment in the year 2000, it's like all the cards lined up or all the bells whistled and buzzed in. Suddenly, I walked into the gospel as if I had never seen it again before in my life. It's like all of these words that I almost know by heart opened up in an entirely new way.
And you write it down.
And I, yes, I mean, I actually remember that night and the next couple of days sitting with a legal pad and just writing and writing and writing and writing and writing. And then it took me almost 10 years to write the initial book.
And that was called, the initial one's called?
The initial book is called The Hidden Power of the Gospel, and it was produced by Harper One in the year 2010.
And it then got given a second edition, which I'm holding in my hand, which is, I mean, no one else can see it, it's a podcast. It's Heart and Mind, The Four Gospel Journey for Radical Transformation, and it's an absolutely brilliant, brilliant book.
Thank you.
Anyone who's listening who knows the Youth and Children's Ministry in it here, if you've spent any time with any of the team, you will have heard about this book. This is a book that gets talked about a lot around here. But it is a really stunning book. I think it...
I mean, and the book is much better than I am. I mean, I truly... I seriously mean that. I sat for years at a computer trying to write this and editing and editing, but there something came from somewhere else. Absolutely. There's, I read the book and I don't even believe I wrote it.
Really?
Truly. There's a depth and a wisdom in it that's not mine.
You've got some beautiful kind of acknowledgements on the back, and some Rob Bell, who most people listening would have heard of, he says it's a stunning book. Well, that's just what I said, but I think I said it first. He says, you won't read the Gospels the same way ever again. You won't think about your life the same way ever again. Anthropology, psychology, the hero's journal, the Bible, fear, struggle, hope, bravery, anticipation, euphoria, return. It's all here in this masterful work. And then he says this, which I love, by one of my favorite teachers, guides, guru, leader, village elder, Alexander Shire. That, because I think the best books, if I think about, because I would compare this, and I'm not sure if authors ever like you do, I would compare reading this to the first time I read Falling Upward by Richard Rohr.
CCC.
And that sense of how can this be so new and yet resonate so deeply at the same time? Like, and we're going to talk about some of it, but that was my experience. My experience was, wow, this is incredibly new and I want to write it all down, but yet at the same time, it's not new. Because it grabbed something in me and just resonated in what has always been true, even if I would never have been able to articulate it.
Right.
And that's what makes it one of those.
Right. And the title, which I love, Heart and Mind, is precisely because I want a Christianity, I want a spiritual tradition which has the best of critical thought, with a devout heart.
Yes.
And I want to be able to go to the Gospels and leave all of that research about the committee argument and da-da-da-da and leave all of that aside and know that there is a deep wisdom here which is greater than any particular person could have composed. It's coming from the source.
And that's why it resonates. Because it isn't about how much context you can add. It isn't about how much Greek or Hebrew you've learned. It isn't about how many other books you've read. It's about this, something connects at a level that transcends us, which I think your book and very few others, I'd have to say, over the years, but there's something about it.
I mean, and there is a particular reason why I'm Christian, and that is my tradition of great heart and devotion. But what this idea does is that it sets Christianity with Buddhism, with Islam, with Judaism, with indigenous peoples, it sets us at a table where we can have a new discussion. Because every one of those traditions has got the pattern of the great human story.
Yeah.
And we can learn by sitting with each other, oh, you understand this about that part of the journey. And this is how we see it from that part of the journey.
You had a flood.
Right.
I totally, yes. Well, let's get started. Right. That's episode one done. There we go. You're welcome, everyone. This is obviously a very special episode of the podcast, although I'm beginning to wonder if it might be two episodes of the podcast. And we're going to do things a little bit differently, but every guest has to make the four choices. So you don't get off with it. Is that all right? So we need to make two of those first up. Where are we walking? Where is this hypothetical hike?
I'm on the Camino. As you know, I take people on the Camino. I walked the Camino for myself in 2012. And now every year I take a group of pilgrims, and I love to walk the wildness, the interior wildness of the Camino in Spain.
And who's coming with us? So you get three people, one living, one dead, one fictional.
I'm feeling very close to my family these days. The person dead is my father's father, my grandfather, who came to the United States with no money and pedaled and walked 500 miles with 70 pounds on his back. And that's how he was able to support our family.
Wow.
I would have loved to have physically walked with him. Mm-hmm. And every time I'm the Camino, he's with me.
Wow. So one living and one fictional. Who else is coming?
So living is my nephew and my great nephew, who's now 3.5, and who I promised I will take on the Camino with me when he's 10. And he just makes me think about the future and about the world I want to help leave for him.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And one fictional.
My favorite, Dumbledore.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He's sort of the wisdom figure that I go inside and ask questions to. And I desperately want that pensive bowl that sits on his desk.
So every guest here on the All Terrain Podcast answers the four questions, your four questions. And in your book, you brilliantly outline how they relate to not only transformation and the journey, but also how they relate to the four specific gospels that they're linked to. So I wondered if we could talk a bit about that as well in this episode, because I think it'd be really helpful for people to hear that. So here's the first one. How do you face change, and how does that relate to the Gospel of Matthew?
Okay, so let's just do the thumbnails of the four texts, and if I start going on and on, just redirect
them. No, it's good.
All right, so we believe that the text of Matthew is coming out of the community of Antioch, the great Antioch on the Orontes River. Antioch is about an 8 or 9 day walk north of Jerusalem. In the year 70, the Romans have come into Jerusalem. They have pretty much leveled the city. They have destroyed, annihilated the temple. And worst of all, they have massacred every person who's part of the line of the Levites and the Kohens, because they want to stop the Jewish religion. And to stop the Jewish religion, they have to destroy the temple, and they have to destroy those authorized to go into the temple. So this is not Hitler who wants to destroy the Jewish people. The emperor wanted to stop this group of people who have this festival every springtime where they know that they overthrow Pharaoh. After the temple is gone and after the priesthood is gone, all of Judaism is feeling that they're at the moment of an apocalypse. And I say Judaism because we Christians at this point are still Jewish.
Yes.
And I mean, we are literally Jews for Jesus, or are Jews who have come to understand Jesus as the Messiah. So Antioch is the second largest Jewish population after Jerusalem. The people in Antioch are feeling dejected. They are feeling like this is the end. They are being told that they have been bad. This has happened to them because they're bad. And that God has ripped up the covenant with Abraham, and that the world now is going to be destroyed by fire or water. The text of Matthew comes to the Jewish Christian community in Antioch and says, listen, the presence of the Christ is with you. This is not the end time. This is the beginning time. This darkness is not how things end. This darkness is how things begin again. And so the text of Matthew is both an inspiring, poetic inspiration to the heart to lift your head up and begin walking again, but it also is a very practical text about how you face into change. And part of how you face into change is how you face into betrayal.
Yeah.
And feeling like this isn't supposed to be happening. This is happening because I did something wrong, or somebody did something wrong to me, or somebody was asleep at the switch. That bad things shouldn't be happening to a baptized Christian. And this text is saying that no matter what happens, our God is standing here and is ready to lift our heads and our hearts and begin us on a new journey. And so the text of Matthew, in the way that I phrased it, is it's the story of Jesus the Christ teaching us about how to face change.
And you write in the book, I'm going to throw quotes at you all day, because I one of the things I do when I read something is I just write everything in the notes on my phone, and so I just have reams of these things. But for me, that it coming out of that destruction of the temple, which was the center of faith, essentially, you say this in the book: although our lives could not be more different from those people in the first century, we still have temples today.
Exactly. We have political structures. We have financial holdings. We have cultural beliefs. And we, all of us, come up to a moment where something in our lives, it may be our marriage, it may be our relationship with our children, that we think is going to never change. And then that moment that we recognize it's crumbled. And is there something on the other side? So yes, we don't have physical temples like the Jerusalem temple anymore, but we all have it. Maybe our temple is our body. And then we become ill.
Yes. For you, the book of Matthew helps us walk through that path of when that temple, whatever that is, has crumbled, how do you move forward?
Right.
And what are some of the key things for that for you?
First of all is the Beatitudes in Matthew. The Beatitudes in Matthew are written to a person or a people who are in the moment of great loss.
That's important.
Yeah, and I mean, we tend to just think about that, but no, these are like it's
well, we think about people having a picnic, but actually the reporting of that is to this group of people who have just had their faith devastated.
Absolutely. And I mean, for me, I remember as a child when JFK was assassinated. I remember for my nephews, 9/11, when the towers came down. You know, we all have these moments where we're shaking. Our roots are shaking. And there's this question of what will the future be like?
Yes.
That's the Beatitudes are written to that moment in us.
So when it says, blessed are those who mourn, that's not one day, that's 2 days.
Right.
That's not when you mourn, it's I know you're mourning.
Right.
And.
Yeah. Every one of those Beatitudes go to a place of grief in us. And it says that the grief is not the place where God is not. The grief is actually the new place of God in you. Honor it. Walk with it. With pilgrims, I'm like, take it as your staff and walk with it. Actually have pilgrims choose one beatitude as what they will walk with on the Camino.
Wow. You just said that grief is the place of God within you.
Yes.
That, like, I like it when people who like know the stuff say stuff like that, and then they sort of move on. Like, that's huge. Yeah. Like, because for most people, even those of us who would call ourselves Christians, even those who identify with the faith thing, and we would go, actually, yeah, I know that even in that moment God was present, the lived real experience is often most of us experience grief as a sense of absence.
Exactly. And our culture has told us that absence is the place not to be, and absence is the place where God isn't. And I'm saying that the Gospels are telling us that absence is the pregnant place of God in us.
Wow.
And I love to partner that with what we hear Jesus say only in Matthew. Mm. You know what the prophet and the law has said, and now I say to you. Mm. And every time Jesus does this, what he says is something which is nonsensical to us when we're in this place of grief.
Yeah.
And that's precisely the reason, because the text of Matthew is teaching us that we have to go to a place of unknowing before we get to the new place of knowing. That you can't go from knowing to knowing.
Yes.
You have to go from knowing to unknowing.
And you write about that. You talk about, we have all heard it said.
Yeah.
Whether that's by our tradition or by our favorite minister or pastor or priest or our mate or the podcast that we listen to regularly, whatever it is, we've all heard it said. Right. But Jesus encourages us to go to the unknown. You have to unlearn that.
Right. And this is why tradition can only take us so far on the journey. And there's a point where we have to put tradition to the side, without saying it's a lie or it's not true, but we have to step to the side of it so that we can understand tradition in a new, larger way.
That's really important, because for a fantastic movement and church like the Salvation Army, which has a heritage and tradition that is so steeped in so many brilliant things, asking people to step aside from that can sound really dangerous. Why is it worth it?
Because we can't go from knowing to knowing. We have to go from knowing to unknowing, which means, I mean, what I know in my life is that every time I have seriously let myself question tradition, thinking in some way, in a delusional way, that the tradition was wrong, I've come back on the journey to understand how that tradition is so true, but in a new way.
Yes. That's the thing.
But I can't get there if I just rotely go along with tradition for tradition's sake.
Or try to drag it with you.
Yeah.
No, you can't drag it with you.
No.
Particularly if we think about faith traditions, actually the fear is often, but if we leave it to one side, we'll never go back to it. But your experience is, if you leave it to one side and examine it, you tend to love it more.
Right. And it comes alive. It comes something vital. It becomes not yesterday's wisdom, but today's wisdom.
But you're not going to love it if you're just clinging onto it for dear life and dragging it with you everywhere you go.
No.
That's huge.
I mean, I could summarize the whole life, death, resurrection of Jesus the Christ in the phrase of, it's life, death, life. And that we have to, in every way, be willing to allow something in us to die with the presence of Spirit with us.
Yes.
And then it will come back in a vital new way.
But we can't experience that if there is no death in the middle.
Right.
A lot of the current movement around theology is about construction, deconstruction, reconstruction. And sadly, I think often deconstruction has become the highlight, and we're possibly not working enough on the reconstruction. But actually, we do have to deconstruct. We do have to tear down those temples and say, why do I believe that?
Matthew is deconstruction.
Yes. Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. And I love how Matthew ends, because this is exactly so true in the practicality of our life. Jesus the Christ, the risen Jesus the Christ, comes on to the mountain, and the disciples are they go to see Jesus on the mount, and I love the text. And some texts say some doubted and some worshipped, and other texts say they both doubted and worshipped. Mm. And I tend to believe that in our humanity, it's the doubt and the worship are right there together. Mm. And then Jesus says to them at the end of this question of change, Jesus says, and now I want you to go everywhere and teach the law of love. But when you're in a moment of grief, that's not what you want.
No.
You want the answer.
Yes.
You don't want to be told to go wander.
No. Or that somehow the answer might be out there, or might be in the going out there.
Right. And then is that great line, and I'm going to give you the only thing which is really true, and it's all that you need. I am with you.
Mm.
And so this end of the Gospel of Matthew, in this way of seeing the text, this is not the Great Commission. This is the answer of saying, yes, God, I'll go on a journey with you. I'll put my hand in yours and I'll let you take me where I would not go.
Even though my starting point is not, because the word commission is something we do to people when they're about to start something that usually comes from a positive place. We wouldn't tend to commission someone if they were crying about it. Right. You know, if we think about it, people listening, if your home league secretary is having to be dragged onto the platform to get her commission certificate, right, you're probably thinking, not for me. But actually the truth is, what Matthew is saying is that even in that place of, I don't want to, the Great Commission stands. It's not a kind of a, and they all stood and saluted and off they went.
Oh, no. And in fact, I mean, to go back to Joseph Campbell for just a moment, Campbell would say that in this part of the journey, if there's not a loud, profound no in you, this journey is not deeply true. You're on somebody else's journey. You're not on yours yet. There's this, you know, call it spirit or whatever, that tests us and that we almost must have a doubt.
And that shouldn't be confused with the sense that God only wants to give us bad things. Because that type of idea then ends up in the kind of in that dodgy place where, if I want to do it, it can't be God. That's not what you're saying. You're saying that there is that balance of doubt and worship.
Exactly. And I love that the text says that. And that's why I always think that the better translation is they both doubted and worshiped.
Yes.
And that the worship doesn't take away our anxiety and our concern and our unknowing and our fears, etc.
Yes.
But that we agree to go in the face of that.
Yes. With and in spite of doubt and worship.
Yeah.
Alexander, we are having such a good time and so many things we need to talk about. We are going to call this episode one, and we are going to come back again. If it's all right with you, will you stick around?
I'd love to.
We will come back again with another episode with Alexander John Shire very soon on the All Terrain Podcast.